The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Ancient Warfare magazine podcast. We're once more between issues of the magazine, so running a topic that was sent in to us. We're going to be talking about unconventional or unusual tactics. Joining me is Jesper Otage, Murray Dahm, Lindsay Powell, Mark DeSantis, Mike Cole and Mark McCaffrey. Jesper, you've never said who suggested the topic.
Sorry, I mean, the gimmies you give Guy and this one are on a different level.
So thank you to whoever the mystery person is that Jesper has now forgotten, sent the topic in.
I'm on my own computer. Can't check, sorry.
Poor excuses. But thank you for sending the topic in. And we have a few topics lined up. So if anyone else has topics or to suggest, or questions indeed, don't forget to send them in. So we're looking at unconventional and unusual tactics. So, I mean, how do we define unconventional or unusual tactics? Someone want to kick off? Because I think we probably all have come at this with a slightly different angle. Mike, do you want to? You were talking about special forces, which is an angle I hadn't thought of until last minute.
Sure. So I think that depending on the period in which we're focusing, there are some standards with how ancient battles are conducted. Right. We have the conception of a battle line. We have the notion that unit cohesion rather than individual capability is critical. We have the skirmishing aspect of light infantry softening up heavy infantry formations before they engage in shock combat. We have the rout, right? These are all things we can view as standard operations for an ancient battle. And one caveat, important caveat to put in there that any veteran listening or watching right now will know, which is that no plan survives contact with the enemy, and that any kind of standardization in combat always, war is nothing but surprises and nothing but extraordinary circumstances. But at least there's an attempt for some kind of regularization in how ancient battles are conducted. And it's not monolithic, but we do see this general tendency, depending on, you know, whether you view Homeric warfare as warriors, you know, sparring individually from chariots, but you do see this line on line, these skirmishing capabilities, this importance on flanking, all the way up until the Battle of Adrianople and maybe even after, as a defining aspect of ancient warfare. So what is special operations? Special operations are operations that deviate from this or produce an advantage for this. And troops that have versatile capabilities that allow them to deviate from this or to perform special roles. So, for example, if you look at the Hellenistic phalangite or you look at the Libyan Roman legionary, these have very specific and almost, one could argue, locked in close combat and, in the case of the legionary, limited missile capability roles. When you look at, for example, the somatophylakes in a Hellenistic army or the agemma, or the some could argue the royal peltasts, although there's a lot of debate on who those were. Some people speculate that these are warriors with multiple kits and specialized training that allow them to perform different kinds of roles. Another example in the Polybian Legion is the soci, the extraordinari, and forgive me if my Latin and Greek pronunciation isn't great. You know, these are troops that have multiple and multifaceted roles. So when we define special operations and special forces troops, I think those examples are a great place to start.
But effectively, I understand where you're coming from. But for example, if you're a Socius, if you are an allied Italian army, right, working under treaty of the Romans, you are fighting conventional warfare in your terms. It's only unconventional because the Romans are putting you with their manipular legion that makes it different. So they're actually both fighting their conventional forms, are they not?
Well, sure, but if you're an extraordinari, you have special duties and special training that is different from other So let's say I've recruited, you know, I've called up under FOTUS, under Didizio, a bunch of Campanians, right? They shouldn't have messed with us. Now they did. Now they're working for us. So I have, you know, in the Alae, line units of Campanians that are doing line infantry duties. The Extraordinari are also doing vanguard and rearguard duty. They're doing reconnaissance duty. They're doing special foraging pickets that the other Campanians in my unit aren't. And I'm selecting them based on specific characteristics. What are those characteristics? That's a matter of debate. Maybe they have special grit. Maybe they are fit in a special way. So I do feel that is special and non-conventional in that one limited.
Would you include in this definition something like Caesar using the 10th Legion in the sense that at one stage he sort of he loads them onto horses as a makeshift cavalry unit? And basically, I mean, is that special forces, or is that just trying to garner the, you know, that special relationship that he has with those troops?
Is that for the meeting with Ariovistus?
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
I mean, I don't know. That's a tough one because, like, on the one hand, these troops do not have specific training to be cavalry or to be disguised in this case. So it may fall into the category of no plan surviving contact with the enemy. And having to innovate.
You've got the same thing where, you know, where Xenophon's commanding at the retreat of the 10,000 and he calls upon the Rhodians, not because they are in his army as slingers, but because they're Rhodians and therefore they are all skilled with the sling staff. And those 200 guys become a rearguard Rhodian sling unit made on the fly, which is very much an unconventional warfare. He also uses the Cretan archers in the same sort of way to lead them on a sort of these small expeditions to go and do sort of extraneous things. So I think there are, even though these people are line infantry, as you say, they all do have skill sets that can be called upon and that their generals know about and are able to incorporate and take advantage of. So I think those are in many ways unconventional and special operations activities. But then again, you know, the Roman legionary building roads, it's like, well, they do these things and you know, where they fall within their skill set of other activities, kind of as slash unconventional and yet expected, therefore conventional.
Well, I'm going to throw this in the mix then. So at some point, I think Mike had mentioned innovation. And you could argue that there's a point at which a set of circumstances defies the conventional way to work. And someone says, I got an idea, let's try this. And that becomes unconventional. And at some point, that becomes the augmented doctrine, or that becomes the replacement doctrine for the previous thing. So this unconventional now becomes the conventional, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you look at the stratagem literature, it's all about be expedient and do what works. You know, in the 900 stratagems collected by Polyaenus and the 400 or 500 stratagems collected by Frontinus are all, you know, expediency by the general in the moment. And there are contradictory stratagems, one doing, I did this in this situation and this person did the exact opposite. Both worked. Therefore, find what works and make it happen, which is kind of a tenet of management. And so I think that the stratagem literature is very much about allowing and sort of giving permission to anyone who reads the book that there are enough examples and exemplar of unconventional tactics to make them conventional in the sense that you do what works and you get done what you need, which is exactly what you were saying, Mark, about, you know, no plan survives contact with the enemy.
Here's a question. If we look at it from a modern context, what does modern special forces mean, right? These are always elite, at least in the American military, but also in the British military, units. They're always smaller than the units they exist to augment. And their whole reason for existence is that they are trained to perform special missions that the main army does not perform. And the question I'm asking myself now is, are there ancient corollaries to this kind of unit? Can any of you think of special forces that meet or are similar to those definitions in the ancient world?
I think, again, we're always going to come back to that old chestnut of the sources don't tell us, like the Himipoi, for instance. You know, the men who run with horses, are they a unit? Is it a tactic? is it something that certain people are called
Mike
upon?
is getting at is, I think, these are units that have tasks that take place outside the normal battlefield, and the Hamitpoi are still very much on it. Maybe if you're looking at a special unit that's selected for a certain task, like creeping into a city and opening the gates for the main army. And I'm sure we can think of examples of that happening, but that's almost always that's a picked group and they're picked for whatever reason.
Even in a couple of situations, it's not even picked. It just happens to be coincidental that someone knew someone's girlfriend was the brother of, the sister of the guy on the tower, and he got started talking. Or even, I think, is it the siege of Halicarnassus, where two of Alexander's phalangites, just unnamed phalangites from one of the divisions, get drunk and have a bet that they could actually take the city, and that escalates into them storming the walls, which was basically bravado, and I bet I could do it, you're reminded of Lieutenant Spears and Band of Brothers by, oh my gosh, you did what? I ran across the battlefield and then ran back again. And I think that in that case, it looks special, but it's almost coincidental. But of course, they were trained to a certain degree. They were competent. They were armed, and they then did this thing off book that becomes anecdotal.
But that idea we have, that modern idea we have of special forces, is quite modern. They are surely a late 20th century thing to take a very small unit and make them self-contained. I mean, I can't think of other than, of course, Sharp. Can you think of a Napoleonic version of the same thing? It's a modern thing. So to look for that in the ancient world might be problematic, even to start with.
Yeah, I think you can go backwards. People will say, well, you've got the Rangers in earlier warfare in North America. You've got other sort of units who were specialized. Even if you look at Viking warfare, where what was the role of berserkers? What was the all of that sort of thing? You can find smaller contingents who did special things.
Well, we do have, we certainly have unit specialization. That's not a question, right? We know that, you brought out that great example of the Rhodians, but we know Agrianians, these are the guys who are javelineers. That's why we have them. And there's a lot of examples of using more lightly armed troops that don't need to fight in tightly packed formations. I keep thinking of Kynocephali, where Flamininus is sending the Aetolians up to scout, where Philip is sending Thracians and other allied Greek mercenaries. And it's pretty clear that they're sending them because they don't have the same weight of kit or the need to be in a big formation so they can move quickly. They're better for scouting. So we definitely have unit specialization. We know we also have elite units, right? We know that the Chalcaspides are better than the Lefkaspides in a Hellenistic phalanx. We know that the first cohort of a legion is better than other cohorts in the legion are considered to be, correct?
Jasper?
Well, then it's just a specific. The first depends on which cohort you're talking about, if that's an early imperial cohort or. Anyway, I was going to say that the elite thing in the ancient world is also related to the particular status of the people in it. They might be. Alexander's companions are elite, but it's also because they're just, they happen to be Macedonian warrior elite that grew up with him, and they all, they were probably better at being horsemen because that's all they had to do all day instead of worrying about, where the next meal was going to come from. I think the later examples of the Hellenistic era, the Chalcaspides and similar units, the references are often so thin that you don't know if that was just, they were equipped in a certain way, they looked a certain way, it was a reference to another famous unit, or are they actually specialists or elite or better trained or are they just palace guards and got better money? Same thing with the Praetorian Guard in the Roman Empire.
And even the Persian immortals. The Persian immortals are not marked out for anything they do differently. Just, A, they wear more jewellery, but they're described in the same terms as the other units of the Persian army, and the tallest and best members of the Persian army get recruited into the immortals, which is the whole Herodotean thing of, well, there are always 10,000 of them, because if any die, they get replaced by the tallest and best of those who are left, which is kind of, they don't do anything differently. They are marked out because of their, you know, silver or gold, pomegranate or apple on their spear, but that's it. They're not, you know, there's no different tactic. There's no different, that's a really tricky one.
Can we say they had a greater impact? These more elite, specialized?
Sometimes.
Where to put them?
Maybe Mark already mentioned the silver shields. I don't think we've discussed morale as a decisive factor in the ancient battlefield. I'm sure we have sort of sideways as a side thing before. But, you know, that seems to be the elite thing about on an ancient battlefield, is that your unit just doesn't break. And in the case of the silver shields, they probably go, yeah, we've seen it all before. You're going to do this and you're going to do that, and you'll kill some of us, but we'll still be here. So just run away.
Yeah, yeah. the Theban sacred band, for instance, which is controversial because of the, you know, lack of Xenophon mentioning them by name at all. But they are elite in the sense that there's 300 of them. Whether or not they're paired lovers is irrelevant to their eliteness. But they're also, their role in the battlefield could be the front rank, could be a wedge, could be a, you know, are they used as a line breaker unit? The phraseology of the sources isn't precise enough for us to actually work it out. But we have other earlier sources which talk about a front rank. You know, the front rank of the Thebans at Delium is the charioteers and footmen, which is a very strange name for an elite rank of a, you know, a 5th century hoplite army, which must imply, going back to an earlier age, why they're called that. But that, you know, that idea that the front rank is better armoured, better armed, possibly better trained than the rest. And again, coming the entire Macedonian phalanx, we know that the front rank is better armoured and they are the best fighters. The second best fighter is the rear ranker, who keeps the rest of the phalanx in place
from running away.
And
yeah.
Murray, wouldn't they need to be? Because these are taking the first shock. And if they don't withstand the shock, then the weaker lines behind it are now vulnerable. So you have to put your best out the front, you know?
Well, yeah, but that in itself then, you know, contradicts our whole idea of this uniformity of the line, because it's not. And it's weird, because when you talk about, you know, early Roman Republican armies, the third line is the elite line, not the front line. And so that idea of, well, how does this all work? Because you then have shield walls where everyone in the shield wall is meant to be equal. You know, when we look at the Battle of Marathon, when we look at the, you know, even the fact that the 300 bodyguards of the Spartan king are interspersed in the Spartan phalanx. So it's not fighting as a unit of 300. It's you know, which again is the idea that we are all equally elite. Isn't that scary, because we're the Spartans, until they meet the Thebans. But anyway, so all of that I think is really interesting in the sense of, yes, I mean, it's completely logical that your best fighters are in the front line to take the first shock. But that also contradicts our idea that a legion is an equal unit of legionaries.
Right. So you have to make it specific to an army or a fighting style. So, for example, that what we've described then would work in a phalanx. But as you've said, in a manipular Roman legion, clearly the dynamics and the doctrine of fighting are different. You've put the light armed troops at the front because that's the way you've worked out your conventional form of combat, because when they're fighting Samnites or Campanians or whatever, that seems to work best. When they get further up towards northern Italy, yeah, maybe not so well, maybe. So now you have to introduce another form of fighting, and at some point someone comes up with the cohort form of legion, because overall that really does mean that everybody's uniform, everybody is pretty much dressed the same, should I say dressed, equipped the same, and presumably is trained the same, and is interchangeable. The parts are replaceable.
Don't forget, on the phalanx, at least, you have the elite unit on the right. That's a known thing.
Yeah, but what makes it elite? Is it, again, is...
Anchor the right, so that you, when you drift, because you're trying to hide behind the shield of the guy to the right, of you, that you don't, you know, that unit will march more steadily forward. But I want to point out what Jasper said about morale, because I think he's on to something there. I'm thinking of Pydna as a good example, where Perseus's Antigonid line just evaporates. And special mention is made of the Agema infantry off on the left, where the mule was originally fought over. And they stand their ground and die to the last man, they alone. That is stressed in Livy. It's stressed in Polybius. And I think there's something to that. Another example I'm thinking of is Alexander and his companion cavalry, where throughout his campaigns, the phalanx's job was to pin the enemy infantry in place, and Alexander's unit itself was to deliver the knockout blow to wherever. And this is occurs again and again, perhaps evidence of an elite unit performing a special role. But I think Jasper made a really good point with the morale thing. I wish I could think of more examples off the top of my head.
If the unit's doing it again and again, it moves away from being sort of unconventional. We've got the unconventional becoming conventional.
It's interesting with the, Alexander's tactics, because yes, the companion cavalry delivered the charge, but he always delivers it with the foot companions and with one unit of the phalanx, always the rightmost. And then the rest of the phalanx follows. So in a way, every single one of his battles is a echelon advance of the phalanx into attack.
And nobody ever figured out how to counter it.
Well, the funny thing, of course, in all of them are move the cavalry to the right, make the enemy's infantry follow you, create a gap, charge the gap. And he does that at Granicus. He does that
in the advent of a lack of mass communication, that everybody he faced, to them, his tactic was unconventional.
Yeah. Well, you look at the Battle of Cannae, you know, the fact that you were allowing the Roman legion to advance into your unit, therefore they were winning, and then you doubled envelopment. That was unconventional. But from a Roman perspective, they were winning the battle because they were moving forward. So, again, that I think you're right, Angus, that yes, it's an unconventional, my gosh, what are they doing? But I think the other thing that's interesting with Roman tactics, and Mike touched on it, that the flexibility and the adaptability of the Romans to make change, to survive, and to recognize that change is necessary, and therefore to create, you know, legions and units within legions that were flexible and able to modify their formation and other things on the battlefield, is unconventional and becomes conventional. Like, you know, like the defense against elephants, which is first mentioned by Arrian for Alexander's tactics against the elephants and the chariots at Gaugamela, but it's again what is copied at the Battle of Zama by Scipio Africanus. So it's like, well, this is what you do when you're faced with this unconventional thing. And it's like, well, surely if that's what you do, therefore it's conventional.
The Battle of Asculum against Pyrrhus, they came up with those wagons, remember? Like, they just built them. Things I've never heard. No one even knows what they look like, but they're talking about they have like extensions to stick the grapnels to stick torches in their eyes and drive them crazy, and like we don't really know what happened to them or whether or not they were effective in the battle. But that is a great example of innovation. The other great example is Polybius. I love this from Polybius. I get goosebumps. Is when he talks about the velites, and he talks about why they're wearing the animal skins on their heads. And specifically calls out to draw the attention of their officers for their individual initiative and, you know, draw attention to what they're doing. And I just, and these are the, like the poorest, youngest, you know, rankers in the army. And they're seeking to draw attention individually. And I see no parallel like that in any other ancient army, certainly not in the monarchical Hellenistic.
Well, that though plays to the Roman virtues of virtus, though, doesn't it? I mean, the whole point is to show courage on the battlefield. And by doing that, you raise your status and stature in Roman society, and then you can go places.
I approach the question of unconventional tactics much in the same sense of what we saw with Cannae, something that we haven't necessarily seen before. What happened? What kind of tactic was used for the first time, at least in the sense that it's mentioned in the history as being something novel? And springing immediately to mind was the use of the Corvus boarding bridge at the Battle of Mylae. The bridge was put at the forefront of the Roman ships, and it was dropped down on Carthaginian vessels. That was something that had not been done before. There would have been boarding bridges that you might have thrown over the sides, but nothing that could be pivoted around and actually stick into an enemy ship. So Mylae 260. Another example of naval innovation was in 413 BC in Syracuse's Great Harbor. The Athenians were noted to have used dolphins. These were heavy metal objects, shape not really known, but it dropped down from beams that were extended over the gunwales of a ship onto enemy ships. When you consider that a Greek trireme was built out of fur, a heavy object dropped from a height would have just smashed right through, and the Athenians lost ships to this. It also came to mind there was on land that there was the Battle of the Jaxartes, 329 BC, in which Alexander it was a defended river crossing. The Scythians were on the other side, and he needed to get over. He sent initially he wanted to actually make the Scythians stay so he could fight them and defeat them. He sent over a unit of cavalry, which the before the rest of his army crossed, the Scythian horse archers swarmed around this first unit. But as they got focused on attacking this first unit, what happened was is that Alexander had enough time to bring his infantry over. And this is something I think very novel. These horse archers ended up being surrounded by Alexander's infantry because they were so busy taking shots at the first horsemen that were sent over. And the final example, at the Battle of Pharsalus, it's noted that Caesar utilized a fourth line as opposed to the typical three lines. He had a fourth refused line to deal with Pompey's much larger cavalry corps. And this fourth line was probably screened from Pompey's cavalry so that when they came crashing in, they weren't ready to see this fourth line waiting there. And in the counterattack, they defeated Pompey's cavalry.
Yeah, they were on the right flank. I was going to say that to your list of naval innovations, because my favorite general is Marcus Agrippa, as everybody knows, and he invented the collapsible turret for the battles of Mylae and Naulochus in 36 BC, and the idea being that you could mount it with artillery, and then when you didn't need them for long-distance travel, you could collapse them, and presumably the drag on your ship was much less, I don't know. But there's clearly a tradition of innovating and coming up with just great new ideas that will fix and solve a problem. So whoever it was said, and it may have been Newmark, about whatever needs to be done to be practical, it is clearly the byline in all of this. Nobody's a slave to doctrine if it's going to lose you the battle.
I think the other thing that's interesting is that a lot of their sources don't report these as this was the first time ever, this was the first time ever. We do get those, normally when the Spartans run away, even though it's like, well, they got defeated earlier. How is this the first time they ran away from battle?
When the Romans built ships.
Yeah, well, exactly. But I think, you know, a lot of those tactics are just mentioned. One wonders whether they're mentioned because they're innovative.
That was my take on it, that the first mention meant that it was novel. That was my take. We can't be certain.
But is it perhaps mentioned not because it's novel? Could it be mentioned how good our commander is to have thought of this? So it's how novel is this? Is our commander is doing something different rather than it might actually been a bit of a nothing in reality?
In a lot of cases, there's a certain... how can I say, commanders taking advantage of certain traits or certain skill sets that are coming from specific groups. I think it's the Agrianians of Alexander's army that are sent up the Sogdian Rock, of course, and noted for their climbing skills in that respect. Same sort of idea is used when you've got the Roman invasion in 43. You've got the Bactrians, not Bactrians, what am I saying? Batavians being used as supposedly good swimmers to cross upstream and then make that, you know, very much like the Jaxartes one that was just mentioned, make that attack downstream on the other side and divert attention so that the main forces can cross across. It's not necessarily innovative because supposedly these groups have got those skills already and may have used them in other circumstances, but it's actually that those skills are being brought into our attention for the first time in that major army.
Well, that was my point about their conventionality is not our conventionality, but the combination of those two things is what enables you to win the war. And that's really all that matters, isn't it? You've got to win the battle, you've got to win the war.
There's also a fact of unconventionality as a propaganda weapon. You know, Archimedes' mirrors that are going to burn the sails on the ships at Syracuse. There's been some cricket on recently, and it's Shane Warne talking about when he was, you know, terrorizing teams around the world by inventing new deliveries, most of which were lies. He just said that he'd invented a new delivery to scare them.
That was the idea that actually came into my mind when I saw this topic originally. It sort of came into mind of the propaganda aspect of somebody like Marius saying, I've got this sorceress Martha with me who's going to tell the future and allow me to... It's Sartorius coming up and saying, I've got this white stag sitting next to me who's whispering in my ear all the time.
Numa Pompilius goes, you know, same thing. Those occur. You know, but even and I think, again, coming back to the issue about when it's mentioned, is it unconventional? The stratagem and anecdote literature, of course, simply locks in on the moment that is the whether it be conventional or unconventional. And some of them are logical and some of them aren't. Like, you know, Alexander telling his men not to have beards because it didn't give the enemy a handhold. Shocking. And, you know, the beard goes out of trend until the second century AD, weirdly. But also in terms of the propaganda aspect, if you look at the De Rebus Bellicus, you know, some point 483, we think, around there, you've got this, we should have side chariots. Here's a weird, you know, paddle boat that can be powered by oxen. Here's a giant bow that can fire over the Danube because that'll scare them. You know, these are, and a lot of people look at them and go, they're just silly inventions. But I think the pamphlet idea of here's some amazing unconventional things you can build has a propaganda aspect to it.
So does it reinforce cultural hegemony? One of my throwaway phrases that I wrote down earlier I thought sounded particularly clever. But you understand what I mean? If one group has it and the other group doesn't, it you know, and you're writing it down, it may perhaps brings people together or raises your group, tribe, however you wanted to call the state nation.
I see where you're going with that. I was going to throw in then to support your position. So, for example, in the wars of Augustus, what's very interesting is every time they conquer a place, for example, Rhaetia, Vintellicum, the Noricum and places like that, very quickly you see a cohort of an ally or multiples of those troops are recruited into the Roman army and they serve who knows how many years because we don't know. But the point is, this is part of his policy. Part of the pacification of a nation, a natio, is to bring their difference, if you want to use Borg terminology, their uniqueness into your own army, and you move them somewhere else so you do two things. They don't represent a threat to you anymore, but you actually utilize what they're very good at. So I think in the case of Augustus, yes, that hegemonistic approach might be arguably part of pacification.
Well, that's why I did sort of wonder if this are always apocryphal or some sort of other hidden meaning without that some of these fanciful sounding stories, I should say, because you never quite know how much is behind them. You know, are they being told to?
Yeah, it's tricky. I think again we've got the problem of sources, but like we also identify unconventional. We identify unconventional at the moment we discover them, where, you know, for instance, the fortification of Decelea by the Spartans in 413, first time they actually establish a base in Attica, you know, within the site of walls of Athens, and therefore what until that time has been a yearly invasion and the destruction of crops by the Spartans can now be permanent, and that's therefore more of a siege than previously. And one of the things that always struck me, you know, these elite Spartan hoplites, the greatest hoplites in the Greek world, burning olive trees and cutting down corn. But, and that's enough, Mike. That's enough. And the idea that, you know, for instance, at the Battle of Delium, where is it Pagondas has a reserve that comes up and is able to defeat the Athenians after they think they've won. You know, that is the first time there's a reserve. This is the first time this happens. This is the first time this happens. And the way that the sources write about them isn't, this is the first time this happened. It's, oh, this happened. And we go, that's the first time it's ever happened, therefore it's innovative. But no one in the sources goes, oh my gosh, it's the first time this has ever happened. We've been innovated. You know, they've innovated on us. We're gone. run.
First time it appears in the sources is what you're saying. It's the first time the reaction is some lacunae somewhere.
But is there ever a second time? I mean, one of our patrons asks, you know, were they ever copied? I mean, did they ever get mentioned again? Is it that they said, that's it? Once it's been invented, written about, does anyone ever mention again an unconventional tactic used for a second, third, fourth time? Or
I would say both all the time and never. When Sertorius has the white doe that he talks to, he's not saying just like, you know. Whereas again, when we troll through the sources, we can see the emulation and the copying of previous tactics, previous strategies, previous moments of propaganda. You know, the number of commanders who you know, say the inspiring word, it's like, is that just something commanders do? Whereas the hypomnium mater in the Hellenistic world of collecting the pithy sayings of commanders, and, you know, therefore commanders know they have to say pithy things because a verbose commander isn't going to get listened to.
So, for example, in the, I guess it would be technically the second or third Jewish war, 132-136, Bachofa's troops are fighting almost a Vietnamese-style war where they're coming out from the ground from caves. But they used that in the first Great War. So they were, in fact, copying a previous successful conventional tactic, if you like. What's surprising is it seems to have got the Romans by surprise, because they'd fought the war in the 60s, 70s, and seemingly forgot about it when it came to the 130s. But the Jews remembered.
Yeah, it's tricky. I think the thing is, you know, like with, can't remember which tyrant it is chopping the heads off the poppies. It's in Herodotus. As opposed to Iphicrates taking the head off a snake. You know, they're the same. This is how you do it.
We have plenty of examples of tech transfer and tactical transfer. I mean, it's literally endless. We have the elephants at Heraclea eating the Romans' lunch. Then we have the Romans using those same elephants at Kynocephali. We have the adoption of the Montefortino helmet, the development of the iron banding and the sputum as a response to the Celts. We have the Romans wearing torques. We have the Caradaces in the Persian army imitating hoplites. We have the imitation legionaries in the Seleucid army. I know that some people debate whether or not those existed. I believe they did.
Debate everything. That's okay.
There's a lot of examples. I mean, there's sort of endless examples, by the way, of both technological and tactical transfer between cultures and armies that are meeting one another. I think that's as bad as close to a ground truth as we can.
And just because this has come up twice and you're talking about, I was going to throw in war pigs. It came up twice. Bronwyn and Cosmo suggested, you know, questions regarding war pigs and flaming pigs. Could they be seen as something that's been taken from somewhere else?
I've got Hannibal tying burning branches to the heads of cattle. And we got that.
I think there are one or two examples of burning pigs, but it's just like they were used there and some decades later, I think.
It's such a slight, well, I find it such a slightly bizarre idea. What I also hadn't realised, having not really been played Rome Total War, that you got flaming pigs in Rome Total War.
Oh, and they're an elite unit that can destroy the enemy, which that's probably the biggest issue. I think someone made the point that they were dropped from the sequel. Because there was a bit of upset about how elite flaming pigs were.
Elite pigs.
The enemy would flee from the flaming pigs as opposed to exclaim bacon. But
I just don't see people. And when I think of it from a practical standpoint, I just don't see how that could be combat effective.
It was supposed to be an anti-elephant tactic, I think. Lindsay and Mike were saying there's tech transfer. And then there's, which is maybe easier to do because it's very practical. You know, you go, somebody has a better helmet. Hey, this works. You know, copy, weapon, that type of thing. A tactic, and we kind of come back to how do generals learn their trade? They learn it from, you know, reading a book that somebody wrote about how do generals behave. But if there's not been, perhaps, of course, there are books, because some of them survive, about the Jewish revolt of 66 to 70. But if that's not a not included in a How to Be a General book, then maybe the second century Roman generals didn't know. I mean, there's no, you know, to go back to modern armies, you know, modern armies, they have an operation and then they analyze it and they go, what lessons can we learn and what do we have to try and make sure that the next time you go into that situation, people know this might happen because the terrain allows for that. There's no, we don't know if there's any such process like that in the ancient world.
And I think you're right. I think the only thing that we know with reasonable certainty is that, for example, certainly under Augustus and later, the military commander had to file a war report, and the war report was typically read to the Senate. And what was interesting is that Marcus Agrippa set a precedent by not sending it to the Senate. He sent it to Augustus, and therefore, from that point on, the Senate was basically cut out of the discussion. It was told what Augustus or his successors decided was worthy to be heard. And we also know before that that commanders wrote biographies of themselves. So they had the opportunity to put their particular gloss on achievements. And, you know, we know that Marius and Sulla wrote these biographies.
Yeah, but they might not, you know, be encouraged to write. You know, I didn't think that there were going to be lots of caves in the ground. And I walked through this valley and my army was swamped.
I think that the interesting thing about surviving literature is that most of it doesn't distill a lesson. You know, the stratagem collections don't distill what you should learn. I think if there's any distillation, it's react to whatever happens and, you know, be expedient.
Well, the article we had about Frontinus a couple issues ago was that looked at how is it put together, the book put together, and what does that sort of, if you read the whole thing from A to Z, what does that tell you if you're trying to become a general? And it basically said, yeah, as you said, all war is chaos, and here is how lots of generals have handled lots of situations. Remember them all, and maybe you can pick the right one when it comes down to it, and it might work.
Absolutely. Aeneas Tacticus, meanwhile, in the 460s, is writing, you know, in the case of being besieged, do these things. So it's very much, in this case, do that, in this case, do that, make sure you do that, make sure you do that, which is very much a checklist. And then by the Byzantine period, you know, Maurice and Leo and things, they also have a do this, do this, do this, do this. Whereas some of the other ones in the middle, you know, the 1,000 years in between those, you've got anecdotal evidence, you've got very theoretical works of this is how you should organize a legion, this is how you should organize a phalanx, Roman general, when you fight like Alexander because you're fighting the Parthians. And we often, modern historians, not this person in particular, dismiss those as being impractical, and yet they survive as a practical genre, which is like, well, what lesson were they teaching? You know, why does Aelian tell Trajan about how to, you know, draw up his elephants? What possible reason is there for that?
At what point, if you're writing, telling people how to do things, they again fall out of use of being unconventional or unusual if it's written down? Can you write down an unconventional or an unusual tactic?
So as soon as it's written down, it's conventional. And, oh, okay.
anyone can read it. So, you know, surely it could be expect. Well, I mean.
Yeah, but I think that this goes back to Max original. I think it's the novel way, or the first time it's used in a different set of circumstances, that makes it unconventional. I mean, if I keep coming to Roman examples, but, you know, if their idea is to bring you to an open plain and you fight the same battle over and over, you've designed your doctrine and your equipment to win ultimately by applying those things super efficiently and ruthlessly. But when the Germans attack you on the march, oops, you know, everything is upended and it doesn't work so well. And of course, the Germans realize this and play the game over and over and over. The amazing thing is the Romans don't seem to learn that lesson.
That's what Marius is, though, arguing against, isn't it? Because Marius comes out and goes against the Senate and says, you're all generals reading from books all the time. I've been there. I've done it. I've been in the concilia of previous generals, hearing about their experiences, their learning and their development of different tactics. So therefore, I'm on the ball. You're behind the game.
But then read about it in my biography.
Yeah.
Well, quite, and, you know, and I think this is where I just wonder again. We come back to the how did ancients read books, and for what I understand, practically they were read out loud, and it's almost the case they were then encouraging discussion. So you might read them with friends, and then you'd have a discussion. You know, what does this mean, and how would we use this? And that this kind of form of learning is very strange to us. That's not how we do it.
I don't see Roman authors or Greek authors winking at us with special knowledge. You know, when we write, when I write this, clearly I mean something different. And yet we do have that in a way. The Spartans, for instance, on campaign, would gee themselves up for battles. And according to the tradition, Leonidas did it before Thermopylae and, you know, on campaign, by reading out Tyrtaeus. And so this idea that you read out lyric Greek poetry about standing in line and not retreating and facing the shafts of war, that is this whole kind of like, yes, because now we know what to do, which is remarkable reading the Charge of the Light Brigade has exactly the same effect on young people during the latter half of the 19th century. So I suppose in a way there are parallels.
That goes back to the point about morale, though, doesn't it? I mean, what you're trying to do in the darkest hour, someone comes up with a form of words which grabs people's imagination and makes them go, you know what? We can do this.
And by the way, I don't know if it'll interest you, but that tradition that you just described, Murray, it exists for me. We watched American Sniper. We watched Lone Survivor. We watched Black Hawk Down. And in all of those examples, we watched them with that express, see these guys that are not quitting. See these guys right. that are taking rounds and staying in the fight. So that tradition, yeah. It actually kind of gives me goosebumps thinking that tradition goes back all the way.
Yeah. I mean, you look at, is it Jarhead where they've got the scene where they're watching Apocalypse Now? Although there are a couple of YouTube videos of Marines, for instance, watching Frozen and getting the same kind of motivational glory out of Let It Go. I wonder whether the cohesion, it's essentially engage. If you engage and bond, it doesn't matter whether you do it over, miniature wargaming, geeking out about Greek and Roman military history, Dungeons and Dragons, opera. I'm being very personal because those are all my things. But I think the fact is, if you cohere, it actually doesn't matter what you cohere over. The cohesion is the thing that matters. And I think, I'm making it very relevant and modern. We're seeing that in a whole series of movements around the world now, which have nothing to do with military units, but there is cohesion of belief and standing together for whatever purpose. And I think that that's a really interesting factor.
The Romans gave that a name, of course. That was called the genius, the genius, that spirit, the esprit de corps, which came together. And of course, they had the insight to be able to embody it in a series of standards, signa or the eagle, and by ascribing sacred meaning to it. Of course, you dare not lose this thing, because if that goes, so does our esprit de corps. So and the same with colors in the British Army and the American Army. It's all the same thing. It's very clever how you leverage symbolism and icons to be able to make this really work.
It's also tied to personalities. You look at, Alexander being one, Julius Caesar being another, that it's actually put onto the commander. And that, again, that exists in multiple ages of warfare, that the commander embodies that spirit. And, when they step into the front line, it's a criticism of your fighting style that you haven't fought well enough for Caesar. Get back, you need to protect yourself, Napoleon, many, many others, that, them doing that somehow admonishes you to fight better, because you've got to the point where the commander himself needs to fight for you. But Alexander, of course, is the opposite, because Alexander must be in the front line. He must lead the charge. You therefore follow Alexander and you follow his example and you keep him safe. Whereas endangering a Julius Caesar or a Sulla or someone, it's a same but different because of the position. Yeah.
So we might have missed what possibly is the best unconventional or unusual tactic, which has been suggested by one of our patrons watching live, the Trojan horse.
I don't want to insult our patron, but you know, there's some questions around that.
What a tactic, you know.
I do love that though as a great example to counter Victor Davis Hanson's execrable argument that the Western way of war is manly, you know, close combat that does not involve treachery or perfidy. And I say the first example of truly great, you know, Western victory is a cheat with this first.
You could argue that the whole, you know, the whole Homeric epic through, Odysseus is very much set apart. He is not conventional.
Can I pick up on a thing that you've just said there, Mike? So, unconventional, unusual warfare, is that cheating? Is that about cheating to win?
I mean, maybe if you're Victor Davis Hanson, but I think in the end, people in warfare are more concerned with victory than they are concerned with the means to get to victory. And I think that we have a lot of ideas of honor and we have a lot of ideas of conventions of war, but those more often than not crumble in the face of the expediency of reality. I would certainly never call it a cheat. And I think that most ancient commanders would find a way to justify it later. There's just so many examples, endless examples of perfidy being the real thing that brings it over the top in the ancient world.
If I could bring up an example from the late Bronze Age too, that from the question of what brought about the fall of the Bronze Age empires, with the exception of Egypt, roughly around 1200 BC, all of these empires were ruled by military aristocracies riding chariots, and they dominated the battlefield for centuries. And then it seems that these empires fell to pieces. The sea peoples came in and either overwhelmed or turned back with only the greatest of difficulties. There's a theory that what brought about the end of the Bronze Age and the fall of these empires were the defeat of these chariot aristocrats. And what defeated them? The chariot aristocrats, the warriors, would have chariot runners coming along with them, infantrymen, who would take on various duties on the battlefield, dispatching downed opponents and things like that. And at some point in time, these chariot runners realized that they had a tactical advantage over the chariot warriors, and that was what actually brought down these militaries. That is, the infantry discovered that they were superior at some point. That is a theory.
Or per Eric Kleiner, 1177 BC could be climactic and natural catastrophes.
Or the Egyptian 1953 iron, which, you know, defeated all the bronze weapons and copper.
Or aliens.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, going back to, you know, Trojan War, even at the Battle of Kadesh, you know, were the Hittite false prisoners who said that the Hittite army was miles away when in fact it was just around the corner, was that a tactic? You know, were they spies sent to, you know, is that unconventional warfare? Not the way that it's reported in the stele, but it certainly reads that way.
Well, isn't misinformation and subterfuge, they're all legitimate tools of warfare. I mean, you know, in our own century, or last century, of course, Winston Churchill had a whole bunch of people whose mission was to do these clever things and come up with armies and inflatable troops.
We still class that as unconventional warfare, even now that would be, when it's sort of conventional, we would still call it unconventional warfare.
Yeah, but we wouldn't consider it a cheat, though, would we? We would actually think it's fair game to win the war.
There's a doctrinal definition. Look, I haven't been an officer for about 3 years now, but there is a doctrinal definition of what we call D&D, denial and deception. And that's you go to school for it. That's a thing you train under. You do. I don't know that it's necessarily, I don't know if it's called unconventional or special operations, but it's like a codified doctrinal thing.
And the question then comes with, for example, whether that would have been something that would have been recognized as something that special that you would teach people in an ancient world situation. We do now because we've got the benefit of all those years.
The thing, of course, that you get across is that it's all down to the will of the gods. So the fact is that whether conventional or unconventional wins is down to their gods. You know, look at poor old, I've forgotten the name, Trojan horse. Don't trust it, yeah, but no one's going to trust you, poor old Cassandra. you know, it's the whether unconventional wins is in the hands of fate, which doesn't mean you shouldn't try it. There you go. I was just trying to, you know, round everything up and close
it. Yeah, no, it's perfect. Put a bow on it. Done.
Yeah. Shall we call that a day then?
Yeah, I think that was a great ending. That was a great ending.
Yes, so, excellent.
Jasper, you're going to tell us what we're talking about next time?
Yeah, Hellenistic naval warfare. And then I didn't respond to Mark's comments about the Roman boarding bridge, because we have an article on that in the next issue, so I have to read that first.
Very good. Don't forget, listeners, if you want to subscribe to the magazine, go to ancient-warfare.com. And don't forget, if any of you want to watch us prattle on live as we record, we do send out a link for patrons of the podcast. To find out more and become a patron, you can find us at patreon.com/ancientwarfarepodcast. Well, that's it for now. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.